Welcome, Nicola Upson, to Radio Gorgeous. We are here talking about Nine Lessons, which is, I believe, your seventh Josephine Tay murder mystery.
That's right, the seventh in the series.
Excellent. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Could you, first, let's talk specifically about Nine Lessons, because I'd like to talk about all the, well, it is historical crime fiction.
It is.
Josephine Tay was a, amongst other things, a crime novelist of the Golden Age, like Agatha Christie, etc., P.D. James, Dorothy Sayers. But if you didn't know all that, it is a detective novel, seamlessly fictionally written, that you wouldn't have to. You don't have to know any of that.
I think that's true. I often make the mistake of thinking that most of the people who read my books are either huge Josephine Tay fans, or at least know that she was a real person and know a bit about her work and the crime novel she wrote. But a lady came up to me recently who had quite happily got to the end of book five without even realising she'd ever lived. So, no, it's nice of you to say that they do stand alone as you know, independent crime novels.
And so bring us up to speed fictionally in the series, because we have DCI Archie Penrose, who is solving crimes alongside and friends with Josephine.
That's right. I mean, the books are set in the 1930s. They start in 1934. And they all start with something real about Josephine Tay's life or her work, whether it was the play that she wrote, Richard of Bordeaux, that ran in the West End, a year-long love letter written to her by an actress, her will, the film she had made by Alfred Hitchcock. She's so fascinating in lots of respects that there's always something you don't have to make up. But yes, you're absolutely right. Her partner in crime is DCI Archie Penrose. He is a nod to Josephine Tay's own character, Inspector Alan Grant, who was, for me, really the first kind of credible professional policeman in fiction. You know, he wasn't superhuman, he wasn't a blundering fool, he was just a normal, hard-working, intelligent policeman who set the model for people like Dalgliesh and Wexford and all those policemen that we love that have come since. So they do work together, and part of that was because I didn't want to make Josephine necessarily fully a Miss Marple character who delves into everything and is the main. That would have been out of character for the real person. So they get through it together. Archie is a proper policing, doing the proper policing, and Josephine is sort of the voice of reason and obviously a very intelligent outsider who looks at whatever situation they're in.
And some of the real, because there are a lot of, as you say, real people peopling the books, as well as real events. One of the sort of series of events was the Cambridge rapist at that time, because this one takes place in Cambridge.
It does. And I do, when I set out to write these books, the first and foremost, I wanted to make Josephine kind of recognisable to the people who love her work, but also relevant to modern readers as well. And I wanted really to bring to life those years, those interwar years that she lived through, because it is a fascinating period of time. I mean, you've got, my books have done the abdication, the coronation, the early days of institutions like the BBC or early days of the film industry. So that's all lovely. But I often play with time zones a bit within my work. In London Rain, I based the 1920s death of a social club hostess on the conspiracy theories around Brian Jones's death, the founder of the Rolling Stones, which didn't happen until the 60s. But the 60s and the 20s, I found, were sort of mirrors of each other. You know, in the same way, fast-living generation coming out of a war, underground music, drugs, all that was very relevant. And the same thing, really, with the crime you've mentioned, the Cambridge rapist, which actually took place in Cambridge in the 1970s. A man called Peter Cook carried out a series of brutal attacks on young women. And it was remarkably easy to transport that crime back, because although in the 70s the people who were raped were largely female students, which obviously isn't relevant in the 1930s in Cambridge, but turn that community into shop workers or nurses at the New Addenbrookes Hospital, and you've still got all those things were still relevant. The suspicion that innocent men found themselves under, the hopelessness of the police, who, through no fault of their own, were just ill-equipped to cope with crimes of that nature. And, of course, the randomness, the anonymity of those crimes, when the man who was committing them could be the person you stood next to in the bus queue or the taxi driver who took you home. So all that's still relevant in the 1930s.
As well as the victims blaming themselves.
Absolutely.
And their sort of tarnished treatment post being attacked.
Yeah, that was very important to me. I think it's something that Josephine Tay did in her own books, not with rape, but with other crimes, is to look at the aftermath of that crime. You know, it doesn't just finish when the culprit is identified and arrested. The after effects of that go on for years and years and years. And in fact, you know, the books I read, when you've been raped, you never are the same again. And I wanted the book to reflect that and respect that very, very carefully. And it's not just the horror of the crime, although obviously that still lives with you, and the fear and the way that a place can be tarnished from you. It's how you go on to deal with your future relationships, what you strive for, what you settle for. And I wanted that to come out very strongly in the book.
I was going to say, as a person who was raped myself, that did resonate very much with me. And it is something that you just don't know how very much it takes from you. It takes from every aspect of your life. It is, as you say, a before and after event. And who was Jill Sayward?
Jill Sayward was a lady who became known as the victim of the Ealing Vicarage rape. She was a vicar's daughter. She was raped in the 1980s. And the vicarage was burgled. And when it came to a trial for the people who committed those crimes, there was quite rightly an outrage because the stiffest sentences were given for the burglary and not the rapes themselves. And she was an amazing woman who took that experience and used it. She educated policemen and judges in sexual assault. She was a tireless campaigner for survivors of sexual assault throughout her life. And she was very, very instrumental in longer sentences and into giving women an identity beyond what happened to them. She always said she didn't want to be known always as that, but it was inevitable that she would be. And I read her book, Rape My Story, when I was doing the research for this one, and it affected me very deeply, and her bravery in waiving her anonymity and writing that down. And she died, very sadly, of a stroke at the age of just 51, while the final proofs of that book were being done. So it seemed very fitting to me that the book should be dedicated to her and to the women who survived the real Cambridge rapist.
Tell me now about another real character, with another large character, M.R. James.
M.R. James, I've loved since I was a child. I grew up with those ghost stories. I come from Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk, which was a place that's very close to where he grew up. Lots of the settings he uses in the stories are places I know well, from the Suffolk coast to the bowels of the Cambridge University Library. And moving on to Cambridge, there is a tradition which still goes on to this day. He was Dean and then Provost of King's in the years around the First World War. And he set up a tradition where he would, after the Christmas Eve carol service, he would take a handful of friends and scholars back to his college rooms, and he would disappear into his study, emerging a bit later with the ink still wet on the page. And he would read them the new ghost story he had written by the light of a single candle. And I've always loved that. I have a friend. It's so powerful, are those ghost stories. You know, they might have been written 100 years ago, but they still affect us. I have a friend who can't sleep to this day in a twin-bedded hotel room. So frightened was she by M.R. James's story, "Oh, whistle and I'll come to you, my lad." So they still live on, but it was the tradition too. And I happened to read in a biography of M.R. James that in the December of 1913, he didn't finish a story for the first time, and he had to read one of the old ones. And when you write books like I do that mix fact and fiction, you're looking for that little window in the truth that's just big enough to get your story through. And so that struck me. I started to think about, why might he not have finished that story? What if it just wasn't the pressures of college business or time? What if something terrible happened that Christmas? Something so terrible that 25 years later, the men who were gathered around to hear that story start dying off, killed in ways that echo his stories. So that's where it all started. And I love, and it's lovely to see that they are his stories are still resurrected in new versions for the BBC, and anybody who hasn't read those stories is in for a treat.
A Christmas chiller.
Absolutely.
And also, so it is, it's really fun to read, sort of trying to pick the fact from the fiction as well, you know, which is wonderful when a book has some different levels, you know, some meatier things in it than just the surface whodunit. One of the fun games is picking that fact from fiction with you. But there is also, in terms of, I mean, these, they come from M.R. James's stories, but there's a quite, tell me about the style that you use, because there is quite a visceral, there's an immediacy, a modern, almost luridness, which I think probably does mirror the thirst for these lurid tales at the time that you're writing about.
It's interesting you say that. I think that's probably very true. It's important to me, while these are novels that are very much about the Golden Age period, they should have a modern frankness to them. They should speak to readers like you and me these days. There's no point, I've found, and people say to me, how do you recreate the feeling of the 30s so well? And obviously there is a lot of research that goes into them. But the trick, I think, is to put the 30s down when you sit down to write the book, and try not to... If you start to try and recreate the language of the 1930s, you'll fail miserably and it'll just end up being a pastiche. So although there's nothing anachronistic, I hope, in them, they do feel quite modern. And I think the crimes themselves, I think the ones in this book, perhaps, are particularly vicious. That goes back to the motivation behind them, obviously, which we won't get into. But it does also go back to... It's very important for me throughout all my books that the murder, the death, should reflect the victim, that it should have something to do with the victim's life and the person he or she was before they became the body. I think that's something that It interests me that women particularly, I think, if they've been victims of murder, become so defined by that crime, and they lose the living, breathing identity that they were. A book I wrote called The Death of Lucy Kite is very much about that, because it goes back to a murder of about 200 years ago, the murder of Maria Martin. And that was, of course, celebre in the country. It was a hugely famous murder which got transformed into Victorian melodramas and plays and films. But somehow you lost who Maria Martin was, because she was only important in the relationship to the person who killed her, William Corder. So the book breathes life into her, and it struck me because 200 years later, in the place very close to where Maria Martin was killed in Suffolk, in Ipswich, Steve Wright killed 5 women. And how many of us can name all those victims? Even though we know his name, we can probably bring his face to mind. So I think it's an important thing that the crime novel does, really, is to stand up for those people in its own small and individual way.
And also, during that time, which does play out in the book, you had to wait for letters to come. You only knew what the newspapers revealed. And so a lot of speculation, a lot of, sort of grotesqueries grew in the mind and also in the editorials. So that isn't out of character for that time, because what we don't know, you know, sort of breeds like mold in our minds.
That's very true. I mean, I agree. Some would say that the Postal Service was much swifter in the 1930s. but no, you're absolutely right. And people did rely on that. And we think we've invented everything in this day and age. We think we've invented tabloid journalism. But goodness, we haven't. Because going back to Maria Martin and that death in 1827... the village that she lived in became the crime capital of the world. A man called James Curtis, who worked for the Times, decamped from London the minute her body was found. He got to know her family. He got to know Corder's family. And he wrote about her case. And you're absolutely right. It swirls around. And people in the... I love reading the papers from the 1920s and 30s when I'm researching these crimes, because they're so useful for the whole atmosphere of society at that time.
Well, and... let's talk a little bit about how you got into writing fiction, because That was kind of accidental.
It was kind of accidental.
You meant to write a biography.
I did. I did. It was, you know, careless of me not to, really. But no, I did. I read a book of Josephine Tay's called The Franchise Affair. And I loved the fact that in 1948, somebody would write a story which was so brave about two women being accused of abusing and kidnapping a girl. I loved the fact that Tay had torn up that Golden Age rule book. You know, there's no murder in that book. There's no real puzzle. Her detective is on the wrong side of justice, and yet that book is frequently cited in the top 10 crime novels of all time. And I loved all her other work. She was very unpredictable. All her books are different from each other. And I loved the fact, too, that in her own lifetime, she was better known as a playwright. She wrote a play called Richard of Bordeaux, which ran for over a year in the West End, and people went 30, 40, 50 times to see it. I remember P.D. James telling me that she was so cross because she was a girl in Cambridgeshire at the time. She couldn't afford the train ticket to go down and see the play that everybody was talking about. So she was an
But that was also written by Gordon Devlin.
Gordon, indeed, indeed. We should say at this point, yes, exactly. It gets a bit layered at this point. Yes. Josephine Tay was also a pseudonym. Gordon Devlin was the name she wrote her plays and her historical fiction under. Her real name was Elizabeth McIntosh, but for simplicity and just sheer energy, I have to just call her Josephine Tay. It struck me that she hadn't had enough recognition, so I set out to write the biography. And she had rolled the carpet of her personal life up very closely, though, and the gaps started to become as intriguing as the facts, if you know what I mean. And it was my partner who turned round to me one day and said, "Oh, for God's sake, just make it up." And, you know, after we got over the shock of that comment, it just seemed such a lovely idea to celebrate the remarkable life and work of a woman who was very, very special. In a truthful way through the books, but to create an original murder mystery in each one. And I remember the first person outlining that idea to outside of our immediate family was P.D. James, and we went for lunch and I told her about the idea and she looked at me in this very stern face, and then suddenly the clouds parted and she said, "Well, dear, if it's legal, you must do it." So it is, and I have.
Well, and also it seems like she was rather impossible to know.
She
compartmentalised her life.
She did, to a great degree. And a lot of those women, she told some lies. If you read biographies of those, or autobiographies of those women, they are whiter than white. Read their private letters, and that's a very, very different story. So there's that all that layering of truth and mythology and fact, which go into the books. And there is a biography now of Josephine Tay. One has come out since I started writing these novels. But still, for me, there are so many things that are still unknowable and unknown about her, and that is what makes her such a gift for giving her a fictional life. And they all, as I said, they all start with something real, but there's also an element of wish fulfillment. She loved horse racing, so I've given her a share in a racehorse. She always wrote that she'd like to make a home of her own at one point, but she died before she had the chance. So in these books, I've given her a cottage and she's had that chance. So there's that combination of the real things about her life and the things that I think she might have liked if she'd been given the chance.
Well, and also if she had lived some time slightly differently.
Absolutely.
Because the mores of the time.
Indeed.
Probably married with her own private proclivities.
Yes.
You know, for privacy,
yeah,
is what I meant.
Absolutely.
For, you know, her desire for privacy and an independent life, sort of, and the mores of the time probably colluded.
Yeah, she was ahead of her time in lots of ways. And I have no doubt that she was gay. There are people who will argue against that very vehemently. But from the letters I've read from women between them about her and from other stuff, I have no doubt about that. But when you're living in 1920s, 30s Inverness, that really is not an option in any town of that size. So it's no surprise, really, that she kept her life in those compartments. And she was a very different person. I spoke to John Gielgud about her, his friend Gordon, as he knew her. And he told me the most wonderful stories about how she would come down to London, book into her private club, a club for nurses and professional women in Cavendish Square, get her furs out of storage at Debenhams, and number those people like Laurence Olivier, Vivian Leigh, amongst her friends and dinner companions. And yet in Inverness, of course, she was a very different person. She had a set of steps that went down the back from her house, so she never had to go out the front and really meet people. So she called herself a chameleon, with typical self-awareness, because never a truer word was spoken.
Mm. And as you say, a lot of her books didn't necessarily have plots, you know, and murders per se. what do you do? I mean, because if you're used to writing nonfiction, tell me about the difficulties of coming up with plot and plotting, and also precision plotting, because in a murder mystery, things have to happen, you know.
I have to say, I think it's the way I do it has changed considerably from the first book. As you say, when Mandy said, for God's sake, make it up, there was the small point that I'd never written any fiction before. So there was that obstacle could come. And it was quite nerve-wracking sitting down writing those...
Make the whole thing up.
Those first...
How to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything.
And I was so worried about dialogue and all those different things, which I absolutely love now. But with An Expert in Murder, the first book in the series, I did find I had to have most of it very, very carefully mapped out before I started. That's not true now. Often I will start a book without knowing. I mean, I know where the opening stuff is going to take us. I know the setting. Setting is hugely important for me. And I know roughly the cast of characters that I've got to play with. But I have started books where the opening chapters, even I didn't know who did it. So, and it's a wonderful ploy, really, because if I don't know, hopefully it'll be even harder for the reader to guess, too. So I'm much freer with that now.
Excellent. Nicola, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
It's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much.